Splendid. Okay, the weather today, highs of 14 degrees centigrade, lows of 7 degrees centigrade. And after a cloudy start with patchy fog, it'll all clear to actually leave a dry, fine and warm day. So pretty much like New Zealand, it has to be said, Jessica.
Yes, very similar. Wow. Mm.
We'd like to start today, it is St. George's Day, by wishing Emma Tinson the very best, because she's a bit poorly today.
Oh,
she
bless.
Obviously, lots of excitement last night. Besides, vital, she comes along to the Harrogate Flower Show, which also starts today. So good luck if you're heading off to the Yorkshire Harrogate Showground. Day one, of course, of the Harrogate Flower Show is in full force, and I'm sure we'll be working through that whole premise as well as the thing proceeds. That makes no sense whatsoever, really. I don't know who actually writes this material. But anyway, I hope they have a splendid time at the Harrogate Spring Flower Show. We'll hopefully be covering that next week. In fact, on Saturday. You see, it's very, very confused in every sense of the word. So who knows what could happen with respect to that. So the perfect smile, a whole range of things coming up with dentist Amit Rai in a matter of moments. In fact, after this.
Hi, I'm Rachel from On Broadcast. And you're listening to Alex Lefchuk on the Midweek Drive.
Well, not quite after this. I mean, we had hoped to actually go to Lily Allen's smile, but we see actually that the machine, that is the computer, has turned around and said, it's possibly corrupted. I don't want to risk playing a possibly corrupted file in any way, shape or form. So let's just wheel back the time to a little chat we had earlier with Dr. Amit Rai.
Okay.
Clearly, as we connect with Los Angeles, it's midnight at that particular time of day, but we always have lots of connections with Hollywood and the notion of the Hollywood smile and so on and so forth. The perfect smile is something which is perhaps often sought after to address this, and also how you can combine the perfect smile with, indeed, sensitive teeth and addressing the challenges of sensitive teeth. We're delighted to be able to welcome award-winning writer, general dental practitioner extraordinaire, the fabulous Amit Rai. Amit, good morning. How are you?
Morning, Alex. Yep, not bad, thanks.
Fantastic to touch base with your good self. This particular aspect, though, in terms of social media improving, the industry of Hollywood and so on, selfies, are people even more conscious of their smiles than they used to be in past years?
Well, that's certainly something that I'm noticing in practice. And I suppose, yeah, if you look at the silver screen and look back at films, even as long ago as 20, 30 years, you'll notice that actors didn't quite have the perfect white smile that they all, do now. So this together with images of TV and glossy magazines has certainly led to an increase for that desire for whiter smiles, yeah.
And yet there's still the challenge, because clearly we've got issues relating to sensitivity and a variety of other factors within that whole system, and how we can actually cope with whiter smiles and sensitive toothpaste. Is there a solution, Amit?
Yeah, well, there certainly is. I mean, tooth sensitivity is essentially this gradual exposure of the outer surface layer of our teeth, exposing the inner surface, which is called dentine, which is certainly up to 10 times softer than enamel. So it's very susceptible to things like abrasive products and certainly aggressive brushing. And this short, sharp sensation, certainly referred to as sensitivity, is something that's quite common, because as many as one in three of us in the adult UK adult population might be suffering from tooth sensitivity, and most of those between the age of 20 and 50.
Recent survey by Sensodyne, of course, shows that also almost half of UK adults surveyed dissatisfied with the colour of their teeth. Now, presumably we are looking at white as opposed to moving into them being green or other sort of shades of the spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in terms of actually looking to that, how can people actually combine both of those, both with sensitive teeth and a natural white smile? I mean, obviously Sensodyne, who commissioned the research, might be one solution for it from that perspective. Is that the way forward in terms of regular brushing, or is it back to flossing again? Is it the old kind of notion of the kind of toothbrush you use and so on?
Well, I mean, there are a range of different options for patients, particularly in my practice, who are dissatisfied with the colour of their teeth. And so what I tell my patients is, underneath it all, you've got a lovely set of teeth. And what you need to do essentially is to start having those stains lifted and removed to reveal what's underneath, which is undoubtedly going to be, a white smile. And so therefore, to start off with something which is fairly less invasive. So something like a whitening toothpaste will be a good idea. But of course, those suffering from tooth sensitivity would need to access access a specific product for their condition, which can certainly help them to maintain whiter teeth with long-term use, but also to address their sensation of sensitivity.
Is the overall pattern of healthcare in Britain, is it improving? Is it getting more problematic? Because, I mean, we seem to have been getting better and better with oral hygiene and dental care for a considerable period of time, but recent surveys tend to suggest that maybe we're not looking after our teeth as much as we should be.
Well, I think it's you know, I think it's primarily a case of which survey do you look at, but also it's a case of, you know, certain dental conditions are entirely preventable, and so that the message out there is also to you know, to brush twice daily, to seek, you know, regular dental attention. But I think in terms of oral health products, certainly we tend to be less engaged when it comes to our teeth as opposed to when we come to buying a product for our hair or our face. I mean, we might tend to look at something which is specific to our hair type or our face type, but we don't tend to do that in terms of teeth, and we tend to instead switch in and out of buying products that might not always be best suited to our needs. And I suppose, you know, the most telling statistic is that only 13% of UK adults suffering from sensitivity would tend to use a sensitivity product on an ongoing basis. So certainly there is that disconnect.
In terms of the way in which we deal with our teeth in general, I mean, you've alluded to that we kind of have different rules for our teeth than we do from the rest of our bodily parts and so on. I mean, the other thing about good oral hygiene, of course, is that it can also identify issues with other kind of general health matters that need to be obviously looked at.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the mouth is a good window into the general health of an individual. And so that's why it's so important that we, you know, we in the dental profession encourage patients and members of the public to seek, you know, attention when they think they might have an issue. But also just to pop down for a checkup when they're due for one is so important, not just to maintain the health of your teeth, but also your general health.
In terms of the dentist, Joe, I mean, I have to ask this question. I mean, have you ever been asked for a selfie whilst you've actually been in the surgery, so to speak?
Well, I know there's a trend. I know the trend in Hollywood from celebrities doing that. I think it's yet to pass over to England.
Only a matter of time, I can see it before too long, before you actually say, you know, me before the actual treatment, me afterwards, etc. Me with my dentist, me with my friend, damn it. It'd be amazing.
Absolutely. And I think we're going to probably have to have selfie sticks in the surgery to help people out with that. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, to me, you see, that's just taking social media just a stage too far, basically. But never mind. That's a different line. Finally, if people are listening to this and they're sort of thinking, well, this is all great, etc. We know we've heard of Sensodyne toothpaste and various other factors. What's the best place to go to for further information? Is there a general website that you'd recommend?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for more information about, you know, Sensodyne True White, or indeed, you know, to learn more about the Sensodyne True White research, you know, please do visit sensodyne.co.uk. But of course, if you want to know more about caring for sensitive teeth, seek advice primarily from, you know, from your dentist.
Amit, it's been absolutely sensational just touching base with your good self this morning. I can understand now why your huge experience as a general dental practitioner and so on has kind of just paid dividends in every sense of the word. I take it you've had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning with the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. Has it been okay for you?
Fantastic. It's been great, Alex.
Well, hopefully we'll keep smiling and look forward to connecting with you again in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you very much.
That concept of actually taking a selfie whilst you're actually in the dentist's chair, I Jessica, thoughts on that?
I'm not for the selfie stick myself.
Well, I mean, you know, as a photographer, you think, what's going on here? I mean, is that what William and Kate will be doing, a selfie stick when the next child actually arrives? Richard Fitzwilliams, you know, are you a selfie crazed person?
Well, I enjoy them sometimes, but on the dentist's chair, I mean, I was put in mind. I'm afraid. I mean, dentists have never recovered from Marathon Man.
Is it safe?
Dr. Zell, exactly. Yes, played by Laurence Olivier. Positively fiendish, tormenting Dustin Hoffman. I mean, then would be the time to take a selfie, your last selfie, so as to speak. I don't know. I mean, it's a ghastly idea. Only it's ghoulish.
Exactly. Showcase cinema, but who knows, if it's happening in California, it'll probably happen in the British Isles before too long.
Not often.
Happy St. George's Day, Richard Fitzwilliams.
I reciprocate.
It's important to celebrate the joys of. I mean, or, you know, it's not. People are trying to get to the stage of saying we should have it in the same way as St. Patrick's Day, etc. I'm not sure whether we'll ever quite reach that stage.
It just doesn't seem likely, really. It's just not caught on here in the same way.
Yeah. Well, you know, who knows what the future could actually hold?
Well, that's precisely why Good Kill is such an interesting film to discuss, because this is war today. It deals with drones.
And in terms of war today, and you mentioned drones, of course, and I can reveal, all being well, a week on Wednesday, May the 6th, Telefantasy and Society, we have actually got an exhibitor who'll be bringing his very own drone along.
That's amazing.
Yes.
So we'll be... I don't follow.
Well, here we are, Richard. I'll just paint the picture. For the last few months, specifically a year, we've been putting together a celebration for 50 years of the television series Thunderbirds. On the 6th of May, we have a Telefantasy and Society symposium taking place at the University of Lincoln at the MTech building, within the MTech building. And part of the fun things, in addition to Jamie Anderson being one of the keynote speakers and Professor Richard Hand from Cardiff Cultural School of Industries and the University of South Wales, and Fiona Moore and Alan Stevens from Royal Holloway College London, is a whole collection of models, events and artefacts. And a whole heap of other goodies, including the Oculus Rift version 3, and indeed a drone, which will be sort of next to either a series of interesting steampunk books or indeed our ragtag Battlestar Galactica fleet as well. So you can actually touch a drone.
You preview it superbly.
You think
indeed,
so?
It's the perfect trailer for my review.
Yes, there you are, you see. Perfect. So you know, let's move into the kill scenario.
A Good Kill, which of course is a contradiction in terms, and it's a very unusual film about how impersonal war can become. Directed by Andrew Niccol, it stars Ethan Hawke in a good performance as Major Thomas Egan. He's a combat pilot. He wants to return to the job he loves, but he's been assigned to an Air Force base near Las Vegas and ordered to take out jihadists, including what could be called collateral damage when there's a subcontracted to the CIA, so an impersonal voice will tell him and his colleagues what to do, and if children happen to run into the frame, or if there are groups...
Collateral damage, indeed,
and it's actually a fascinating film. I mean, obviously he becomes affected by this, he becomes traumatized, he turns to the bottle, and his marriage goes very, very on the rocks. I mean, he's married to Molly, played by January Jones, but he's very attracted to Vera Suarez, who he's working, played by Zoe Kravitz. She is affected by this, and it's extraordinary. One of the aspects of this film I would dwell on is it's rather like a video game. It is bizarre. There's something weird. There's something quite compelling about sitting in some form of, it's a sort of shack in the airbase in L.A., and you're taking out someone in Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, Afghanistan, or whatever. There's something quite horrifying about it, and yet there is a curious fascination that this film exerts. Bruce Greenwood, a good performance as Colonel Jack Jones, who's the boss of it all. He's human, but war has to take precedence for him. And it shows how superior technology. Churchill talked about the lights of perverted science, and I think this is one example.
One of the things which impressed me about the movie and probably appeals to me is the fact that it was written by Andrew Niccol, of course, known to many for The Truman Show and Gattaca. And Andrew Niccol does like to kind of explore the near future in terms of speculative fiction and the approaches that you actually get within that. He actually addressed the whole concept of actors being replaced by synthespians. In fact, I think he coined the phrase synthespians, where they're completely working through that. We're looking at the trailer. Jessica, from your sort of war interest and war reporting perspective, does a Good Kill, where actually the soldiers effectively sort of sit in the desert somewhere and they press
the
buttons.
It's a bunker, yes.
Like
literally,
video games
and
so on.
Yeah, the nearest they have to sanity, apart from their families and the base, is Las Vegas, and that has its temptations. That we know. Prince Harry will remember that.
Does it appeal, Jessica Ward?
Yeah, it definitely appeals. I think it's a really important issue, I suppose. Just the whole kind of concept, whether you... you can see the different points of view. People enjoy that kind of killing, some people don't, so it's kind of good to
I'd just like to put a little caveat there. I hope listeners to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition don't enjoy any kind of killing.
Yeah, guys, make sure you don't.
I mean, I assure you...
I don't know what they do in New Zealand, Jessica, but please.
The message of the film is that the way those who actually, as opposed to when you're a pilot, there's at least you could say something somewhat more human about it.
Yeah,
I mean, you're 7,000 miles away and you're... pressing buttons that you could be pressing in some form of utterly bizarre video game.
So let's move on to a little chaos, which possibly drones could cause, and indeed do cause, in their own little way.
How right you are. It's directed by Alan Rickman. The second film is directed, and I have to say that set in the 17th century, it's rather extraordinary. It's about building a fountain at Versailles for Louis XIV, played by Alan Rickman. And it's Matthias Dunhart, a very good actor indeed, is André Le Nôtre, Louis XIV's landscape gardener. He needs an assistant, so he gets fictional, by the way, Sabine de Barra, played by Kate Winslet, and the romance blossoms between them. The chemistry between the performances, between them, is rather convincing. It doesn't attract André's wife, Francois, played by Helen McCrory, as you can imagine, and there are some rather delightful cameos, including Stanley Tucci camping it up as a courtier, and also Rickman himself as Louis. There's a very amusing scene where Sabine mistakes him for a horticulturist when he's just taking a turn in his garden. You could ask why make a movie like this? What's its message? And it hasn't got a great deal to say about the human condition. I do admit that. It's had some very mixed reviews, but there's a lot to enjoy in it, simply about the colours. Somebody compared it to a sort of Downton Abbey at the time of Versailles. I mean, if you like wigs, costumes, the colours, a period romp, you'll enjoy this.
Trailer says, a little risk can change everything. A little risk can change everything. What's such a, it's fantastic stuff in that sort of routine. Period drama at its best, really.
Well, it's fun. I mean, I wouldn't say at its best because there you're looking at great epics, but I would say that Rickman's having a lot of fun, and those who would enjoy this type of movie, realising it's a bit of froth, are going to get a lot of fun out of it.
A bit of froth. Do you know, I would have laid odds, given that Her Majesty the Queen has just celebrated her 91st... 89. There we are. Just double checking that. Yeah,
close.
Exactly.
She won't be pleased.
There we are. 89th time on the. Well, she has two, CC, so sometimes it gets very confusing in terms of the official one, the unofficial one, etc.
Edward VII decided that the winter was not the best time for it, so he did decide on two, yes.
Well, I would have thought, actually, Richard, you would have actually gone, and if you don't go for this week, you certainly go for next week for a royal night out.
Unfortunately, I've seen the film and I've seen it, unfortunately, under embargo. I cannot talk about it until the 10th of May. And I very seriously mean that even if some writers...
Richard, it's all right. I will speak for you. You know, I'll say on VE Day 1945, Princess Margaret, when she and her sister Elizabeth were allowed out from Buckingham Palace for the night, where they encounter romance and danger. The trailer's
say
out.
No more.
No, no. I wouldn't dream of sort of cutting across your whole thing, but I would, as I said, Jessica, I would have thought there's odds are that that would be mentioned in terms of something that happened on VE Day, allegedly. And anyway, but meanwhile, clearly, the Duchess of Cambridge has not played to the original synchronised system of actually having the delivery on the same day as Her Majesty the Queen celebrated her 89th birthday.
There's always St George's Day, or there's always the day of the London Marathon, or indeed the fourth anniversary of their marriage. I mean...
From your own point of view, as a royal correspondent for CNN, for Al Jazeera, for a whole heap of Siren FM, of course, Siren 107.3 FM, is it a case of you kind of encamp yourself with various sort of contemporary sort of stuff, or do you go out there to that? And what's the tension like, Richard? How's it mounting up, really?
Well, for example, they've decided that they do not want a repeat of what happened when, for a very considerable time before the arrival, we know what was camped outside the hospital. I mean, it was absolutely vast. Of course, George was is the third in line to the throne, and we know that he or she, because we didn't know the sex of the baby, we still don't, by the way, even though everyone's convinced it's going to be a girl, and also called Alice. The point was that the media circus was absolutely phenomenal, and this time, though there are a few diehards who are great supporters of the monarchy, apparently camped outside. See, I mean, nothing of the sort is going to happen.
I've got to say, Richard, and I've pointed on this before, I mean, much as we love the royals, the fantastic in their own sort of way, I don't think I'd ever really necessarily want to actually camp outside just waiting for
the birth. It hasn't been made compulsory yet, believe me. No. I mean, one of the problems, obviously, we'll have whatever his or her sex, we will have very, very shortly a sibling for George. And the facts are that apparently, I was trying to find out why they were so convinced it was going to be a girl, the bookmakers, I mean, because the couple say they don't know, and I believe them. And apparently it was because they discovered that, this shows when you're royal, any comment, anything you say at all can be interpreted, maybe correctly, but we know that certain pink material has been ordered for Anne Mahal.
Pink material?
Yes, where they are, of course, officially based in London at Kensington Palace. That's where allegedly they are at the moment, and Anne Mahal will be where the baby will be heading within a couple of days, probably once the Queen has played a visit, as last time, which was historic because when George was born, when the Queen visited Kensington Palace, there were three generations of future royals in the one room with her, and that hadn't happened since 1894 on Queen Victoria, and it was quite amazing. I mean, I'm sure there'll be another historic such moment. But it's very interesting if you consider that William's determination for privacy is such that we haven't in Britain seen George, I mean, photographs, yes, of the christening or those which were taken by Michael Middleton, but we actually haven't seen, had a photo opportunity with George since he was proudly displayed.
And frankly, I'm not all that concerned. You know, let him get on with his life and sort his way through that whole process. We don't want to see paparazzi.
No, I absolutely agree. And remember what a star he was on the trip to the Antipodes New Zealand, and in do you remember the zoo with the bilby?
Who could ever forget the zoo with the bilby? write in your answer now to sirenonline.co.uk. Splendid. Richard, a little line, a real winner, a genuine feel-good film is what a royal night out is already getting. But obviously you can't talk about that, so we'll wait until
I am tempted, but when I sign an embargo,
I know, exactly so.
You're having fun. You know I'm tempted. This is Alex at his most mischievous.
Ooh!
The trailer looks good, though.
He knows I hate being gagged. No, he knows this. That's why he's dwelling on it, and that's why he's brought it up again.
Yeah, well, there you are. However, you know, the official line that Richard has been allowed to speak about, apart from Royal Baby Watch and so on, or Baby Watch in general, A Little Chaos and A Good Kill, two movies which I think Jessica, you sort of think, yeah, you probably sort of check those out in the fullest of time.
Yep, I think they'll
excellent. Coming up very shortly, Rachel Abbott will be talking about love and romance and what is it. I mean, Richard, if I was to ask you in terms of little objects, that whether it might be a mug, it might be a pen, it might be a particular walk in the country, anything that kind of has a romantic association with yourself. I don't want to go into details, but is there any sort of object that you'd sort of say, yeah, that to me signifies, you know, a nice bit of romance?
An object that symbolizes Roma. What you're thinking of, rings, for example.
That
would occur to me, but then it's an obvious one.
It could be a book, it could be reading, it could be an activity.
Well, if it's an activity, I mightn't be able to mention it.
All right, Richard, fine.
You asked for that. That's my revenge for Royal Knight.
There you go. Jessica, last two questions for Richard Fitzwilliams, please.
Okay, Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Yes, I have.
And will we be hearing from you soon?
You certainly will.
Wonderful.
Excellent.
You're listening to the Midweek Drive on Siren FM, guaranteed to keep you safe from giant lizards.
you know, those kind of things. I need love, love.
Stuff. Siren 107.3 FM, and it's coming up to, in fact, exactly 29 minutes and 32 seconds past 8 o'clock on April 23rd, St. George's Day. Fantastic stuff. Now, oh, we did mention that we would be hearing from Rachel Abbott, and we did briefly hear from Rachel Abbott, but really the key question that she was wanting to ask Linda Papadopoulos, and if you recall last week we had lots of fun trying to actually get hold of Linda Papadopoulos, not in a kind of problematic sense, just in technological scenarios. So Rachel kindly stepped into the breach and actually started thinking about the whole love question.
Now, love, I personally... I'm always questioning, like, what is love to me and, you know, my imagery and stuff. But there's some new, there's a new study out from eHarmony. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely. So what we did is we looked at a competition, which is actually taking place this year as well, called Love Captured, where we asked people to send in photographs entitled What Love Means to Me. So we took all the entries from last year and looked at how they clustered and looked at the top symbols of love. And unsurprisingly, I guess, things like smiles and kissing and hearts and hugs topped the list. But also there were some really interesting, unexpected things like water and trees and bridges and benches.
I love water.
Yeah.
I think that's a lovely one. I wonder if there's a really unusual one. Like, is that dogs?
Dogs, a cake. Cake was one of them.
People have been really creative.
They have, yeah. But I guess it goes to show you how, you know, the symbols of love are actually really important. We kind of think about them and, you know, we think about Valentine's Day or we think about first dates or engagement rings. But actually, I think we ascribe meanings to things that make us feel centered or contained. And I think that's why things, you know, like, you know, being near the water, near the sea, gives us that sense of kind
calm.
Of connectivity and calm. Exactly. So, no, it was really, I've got to say, just some really beautiful pictures. And I would urge anyone out there who's, you know, just go through your smartphone and think, what, you know, what does love look like to me, and send it in, because it's really worth, I guess, also looking at how other people perceive it too.
And I wonder if people could kind of, a couple could almost like draw and compare and work together.
Yeah.
Do you think there's what kind of messages within the objects or symbols people are drawing that could almost help? So say, you know, there was someone who maybe wanted a bit more sensitivity, maybe she would draw water or hold my hand.
Well, hand was a big one there. So again, the idea that they're an important part of body language, they have associations with things like engagement and just touching and you know, connecting with people physically. I thought that was lovely. There's some beautiful, stunning pictures of hands that people sent through.
So maybe when people are meeting as well, they'll start to be more creative. They could bond through their art.
Exactly.
So what else does the research show?
The other thing the research shows is that cross-culturally, there's some really interesting differences. So when we looked at what people, for example, in South Korea saw as love, they said it was diaries full of memorable dates. These were, which I thought, oh, how sweet. China and Japan, the maple leaf, because apparently depicts sweetness and wonder in everyday life. So some really lovely things. So I think part of what we're seeing is cultural. Part of it is just pop culture. So, you know, and then part of it, I think, is that more visceral, you know, it's always been there and probably will never change, the really back to basics things.
I think we get so caught up in everyday life. I'm going to draw from that one.
Good for you.
So if anyone wants some more information or can take part in this.
Well, if you want to take part, it's called the Love Captured Photo Competition. It's running till the 15th of May. And what you need to do is go on to eharmony.co.uk/lovecaptured, send in your picture, and you could actually win £1,000, or you could actually be part of a love-themed photo mosaic by the renowned artist Helen Marshall. So all good either way. So I'd say definitely send those pictures through.
I love a mosaic. What would you draw? If you could close your eyes now and draw something.
I'm a terrible drawer, so I'm going to draw a heart.
A heart.
Back to basics.
That's lovely. Thank you very much, Linda.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And thank you, Rachel, for that little item with Dr. Linda Papadopoulos. One little minor question, a side point really. When Rachel wrapped up that piece by saying, close your eyes now and draw something, was she actually trying to ensure that our ace correspondent there from eHarmony and psychologist extraordinaire was going to be drawing things with eyes closed? Surely that defeats the object. I don't know, it's just a thought.
Maybe it's all about feelings, you know, let them free onto the paper.
Exactly, it's mindfulness. It's why colouring books for adults are so important these days. But it's amazing. I mean, will you be entering that competition, Jessica?
I don't know, maybe. Maybe £1,000. I'm a student, so...
Exactly, just go to the Love Captured part of the eHarmony website.
And check it out.
Exactly, you can work through that. Who knows what part of romance Ian Lennox would actually say is probably a shirt with black and white stripes on, I suspect, but maybe not. How are you, Ian Lennox?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, that's what I like to see. I could go straight to Jessica and say, how's the reading of the book coming on?
I'm prioritising my revision at the moment.
Prioritising revision.
Sorry, Ian.
So the Easter period.
Oh, don't worry.
But I have a little text which I'm going to read to actually launch through today, and I wonder Ian, if this actually sort of resonates with you in any way, shape or form. A little excerpt from a classic text I actually just selected as a little treat for myself recently. Finally, amidst the din of roars, cheers and rattles, the team appear in the director's box with the cup. Somewhere over there is Bobby Mitchell, with his dark hair swept back and grinning broadly, showing off his tombstone teeth, and George Hannah, a modest forward who plays in the most unfussy way and who is looking a bit bemused by the whole thing. And there's War Jackie, who until a couple of years earlier had been working part-time as a fitter at Hazelrigg Colliery, holding the FA Cup aloft in one hand and smoking a cigarette with the other. Next to Milburn stands the team's cheerleader, known as Mr. Newcastle. He's wearing a zebra hat, zebra pyjamas, and a giant zebra rosette. He's encouraging the crowds to start singing. I want to know, Ian, what were you doing as Mr. Newcastle wearing zebra pyjamas back in 1957?
Wow.
50, or 6?
57, 55, I think.
Was it 55?
I'm not sure. I know that was about 10.
Well, these are the critical lines. I mean, let's be precise. It was indeed May the 8th, 1955.
Yeah.
It's very different back then.
I'll carry on for a little
bit. And who did we beat?
Well,
hey?
I'm coming.
Come on,
I'm,
Alex.
The Don Revie plan didn't quite work, but I will actually.
Who was Don Revie playing for that day?
I'll continue.
He was playing for Manchester City, wasn't he?
I will continue with this little line because the zebra clad man starts with the Newcastle United anthem, which I'll actually ask Jessica to share in a few moments. But it's basically, "Oh me lads, ye should have seen us gannin'. Past the folks along the road just as they were stannin'. All the lads and lasses there, all with smiling faces, gannin' along the Scotswood Road to see the bladin' races." The song, according to the author, we haven't identified the author of this piece as yet, is unrelenting, and all the players join in, all of us singing it like our lives depend on it. The players salute the crowd, milking the applause for all it's worth, and then finally, as if acting out some invisible signal, they're gone, out of sight. Next day in the press, the manager, Stan Seymour, talks about how this will be a springboard to greater success for the team. But over the next decade, the majority of the headlines will revolve around tales of behind-the-scenes bust-ups, arguments over the club's meanness with money, and storm-outs over dirty team baths and unfit club houses for players. A classic tale of lost hope in a one-club city. Apart from a solitary Fairs Cup win back in 1969, there hasn't been quite a day like that FA Cup homecoming since Newcastle United. The talk of the tune. Now, Jessica, allowing for obviously what Ian was saying there in terms of who actually were at the receiving end of, I think it was a 3-1 scoreline, and in the 1955, would you like to describe the author and what we see on the picture there, given the sort of classic overhead kick that we see there? What's the book reveal all, please?
Ben Stewart.
Okay, so it's forward by Carlos Alberto.
Yep, forward by Carlos Alberto, and the author of the book
is Dennis Tewart.
Sorry. That's exactly
so. And it's
so.
Called My Football Journey.
My Football Journey. You see? And it starts
riveting.
Off on that day in May 1955 when he first had that routine and goes on to obviously share how ultimately his true love has always been Manchester City. So there we are. Just despite the result, Ian, it still shows that the spiritual home is clearly not St James Park.
His spiritual home wasn't. No, he was born in Sunderland.
And yet he was brought along to actually celebrate that FA Cup win when, as the local press said, it was all easy peasy. It was just easy going in all sorts of ways. I just thought you'd like to share that moment here on St George's Day.
How old was he when he did that? Because he played in the Cup final of 76, I think it was.
75. And 73, of course. 73 for Sunderland. And actually, no, you're quite right, 76. You're quite right, yeah. It was 1976.
The goal he scored against us. And he was transferred. I mean, he played in the 73 Cup final for Sunderland.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then was transferred with Mick Horswell to Manchester City.
In 1974.
And Watson, what's centre-half went as well.
Well, Dave Watson, of course, yes, yeah. Also headed off from that point of view. And Jeff Clarke went the other way. Thank heavens, because he scored more own goals for City than most players did. But there we are. Anyway, apart from the sort of area, he would have been probably, when the thing was there, just a wee lad, a wee bairn, to use a northern vernacular term here. Wee bairn, probably about 3 or 4 years of age, effectively.
Right. Yeah. Oh, very, very happy days, yes.
Well,
yes.
There you have it. And Jessica, I hope you appreciate the fact that we've shared some of our religious background in terms of...
Well, I think it's great.
In the words of Bill Shankly, I mean, we had hoped that Jared, the Arsenal supporter, would have been here, but a typical Arsenal supporter routine, he gets his own show and so he just doesn't want to know us, you know. But clearly, from that whole sort of system... Actually, I say that, that's a little sneak preview.
Are you going to give Jessica that book? She'll not read that one either, won't you?
No. She can when obviously she worked her way through the cricketing genius that is, of course,
that is right.
Gentlemen and Players.
I will get that done.
Exactly.
I'll not let you down.
Happy Christmas.
No, she managed to work her way through The Truth Is Out There. Admittedly, that was a DVD and video and so on. So, you know, and she did it in portions as opposed to the whole thing. So that's
which
great.
Which was a mistake.
Well, all I can say, Alex, is don't give her War and Peace to read.
Yeah.
Look, Tolstoy wrote it with Jessica Ward in mind, you know.
150 final challenge.
Yeah, 150 years ago when Count Leo Tolstoy was actually, and it's the old line, Count Leo Tolstoy, 2, 4, 6, I don't know. It's an old line. But I'm sure he actually sort of thinking, yeah, I want to write a novel about the Napoleonic Wars and the Russian scenarios and the rise of the whole range of things there, and I want it to actually be for Jessica Ward to actually peruse. Meanwhile, Jessica, would you like to give a little shout out to your mother?
Oh yes, of course. Just say hi to Bronwyn Ward in the Isle of Man, and just hope that all of her assignments and everything for her master's degree is going well.
Yeah. So, and what is her master's degree in?
I have no idea.
See, that's how close a family
teaching.
They are.
I know, so such a tight bond, but it's something to do with teaching anyway.
Something to do with teaching, Bronwyn. Well, it makes sense, doesn't it, Ian, if you're actually going to do a postgraduate, you know, do an MA in something to do with teaching.
She's one for detail, isn't she?
That's right.
Last night, of course, our regular Californian correspondent, of course, will be Phil Leonis and Arthur Weingart and a whole heap of others. Now, our regular Nashville correspondent, of whom there can only be the one, which is Cameron Tilbury, brought along a chap called Nate Evans. We weren't sure whether it was Nate, short for Nathaniel, or whether it was Nate, you know, just Nate, as in Nate's great. Or indeed it was somebody whose girlfriend was actually doing an internship with Maple Star Music and Media, and that's how he actually managed to get his song played. don't look at that, you know, in any way in a negative sense, Ian, but are you ready to have a listen to Nate Evans with something we could analyse from the linguistic side of things, because it's a thing that's entitled No, with capital K, A Thing. That's No A Thing. So you can actually know something, presumably, or know a thing, or maybe it's just nothing, as in nothing. But we don't know. Are you ready to have a listen to this? And it is quite mellow, so I'll warn you, it might just send you off to sleep.
Right.
Okay, then.